Okay, let's start. Topic today is ethics in research. Quite important. The lecture today will be maybe just an hour or something. Practically, or it, but most of you will probably meet me later today or tomorrow for data analysis, so just remember your appointments there. Yeah, research ethics, what is it? Actually, it's not a very it's not, or there are very few exact rules when it comes to research ethics. It's a set of guidelines, considerations you have to go through when you are doing research. Considerations you have to take. It has to do with how you treat participants when you are doing research on humans. It has to do with more of these professional issues which we have talked about a bit earlier and which the library talked about. Plagiarism, faking data, scientific misconduct, those things. So we won't spend much time on that now. And there are some issues as well when it comes to the relationship between science and society, how data should be, how results should be treated, how things should be reported, what we should focus on. Of course, it has its history in misconduct or things that has been done wrong in history. A lot of the examples or a lot of the formal writings on research ethics comes from medical research. And of course it comes because there has been quite a few situations where, well, researchers have crossed borders or done things they shouldn't have done. It's often referred to, well, the history of this is often when it comes to how things should be formulated, and when this first formulated rules of ethics or guidelines for ethics, well, it leads back to the Helsinki Declaration in 1964. Well, of course, you had the Nuremberg Code, but that has had very much to do with crimes during the war or the Second World War. But in this Helsinki Declaration in 1964, the World Medical Association set down some rules for how research should be performed. And in that paper, this stated that informed consent and voluntary participation of subjects is the essential element in all, in this case, biomedical research, but it has also become the standard for how we treat subjects in all other types of research. So what do we mean then by voluntary participation? It could be a straightforward thing. You could ask people, do you want to take part in this? But there are difficulties with it as well. Of course, there are, for a lot of the research we do, this is pretty straightforward. There are little consequences for people to take part in the studies we do. And when that is the case, well, it's usually enough just to inform people what this is and do you want to participate. You just ask them simple questions. But there are instances where this isn't this easy. And one term that is often referred to there has to do with competence. Have you got the actual competence to say yes to participate in research? Age is an obvious thing when it comes to this. Can you include children in your studies? And when can you do that? When can you say that you have informed consent by children, for instance? Well, there are some legal limitations. So some of this is stated legally. But that's not necessarily very easy either. You say that, well, in Norway in general, you say that if you are 16 or older, you can say yes to participate in most types of studies, not including studies where medications are involved, but for most types of studies, you can be asked, or you are competent to take responsibility for participating in this research when you are at least 16. But of course, that's a very high age. If you're doing studies, for instance, on technology use and children, stuff like that. And it clinches with other legal stuff that has to do with when are people supposed to be allowed to tell their meaning or something like that. Meaning that now and then you can actually let younger children take part in studies without asking their parents, for instance, to take the responsibility for them. So, as a general rule, when people are 12 and or older, and where the consequences are very limited for the child, you can. It's straightforward to include them in the studies. Skills, knowledge is another maybe another difficult topic here. Do we have the right? For instance, if you ask people to take part in let me just give an example. A few years ago, when I was working at a hospital in Norway, where they did rehabilitation of patients with neck injuries or back injuries, paraplegic people. They invited me to take part in a study as a control, as being part of a control group, where the topic had to do with training, exercise, using this type of what do you call them? Ergometersykkel. They were cycling with their hands. And what seems to be the case is that a lot of paraplegic people or people with neck injuries, they seem to strain their muscles too much. They don't have the same signals or the feedback to the body when muscles are under pressure. So this was a medical study where they, in addition to measuring hormone levels for when under exercise for people with neck injuries, they used a number of us as test subjects. Of course, we were informed that participation in the study was voluntarily. And then there was this nice letter joining this invitation that said something about putting in a catheter in a vein or stuff like that, which I really didn't take notice of or didn't see or didn't know what meant. It's actually a quite interesting thing. They what happened was that when I came into this study, I was put on an operation table covered with a cloth, and a surgeon came in and opened a vein and put in a catheter that was put long or into my stomach or something. And I had to pedal on a bicycle, this hand bicycle, till I was totally worn out over one and a half hour or something. This took place. And they took blood samples every 5 minutes or something like that. So it was, well, of course, participation was voluntarily there. I was informed. But very discreetly, I would say. I was also told afterwards, please don't tell the others what you have gone through now. Was this okay? Well, the problem was, of course, that I not necessarily understood the information I was given. Did I have the competence to read what was expected of me here? Well, no, I didn't. I would have taken part if this doctor had spent time with me as well and informed me. So, well, it's just to point out that this isn't necessarily easy. And you can meet the same type of situations. It's not necessarily that you're pushing people this far, but well, you make people spend a lot of time, for instance, with new technology. Technology that makes them feel maybe uncomfortable or something, that steals time from them, that's difficult to use. So these are considerations you have to take. So explaining things in a language that the participant is capable of understanding is an important issue here. So how do we solve this part of voluntary participation? You should always, when you do research, make sure that you have written, that you make a form or that you inform participants about their rights, that you inform them about the content and the purpose of the study, that you inform them that they can decline participation even when they have started up, that they can at any point withdraw from the study. You make such forms, and it's easy to find examples of these types of forms on the net. I think I just Found one from Stanford, which is but you can find these things when you search for it. So this is the type of formulations you tend to include in a formula. You usually start up with some general information about the study, and then you say how data should be treated. You say the stuff that I told you about the possibility of withdrawing without any penalties to it. But you can find these things, and it's pretty easy to do it. And you should, when you do a master thesis project, for instance, make sure that all participants have signed such a document, and you should keep this document. It's a requirement that we have to meet, even in pretty basic type of studies. There are exceptions. For instance, when you are just sampling or doing observations of something completely anonymous, or when you are performing quite straightforward type of service, for instance, where there are no recording of personal data, like most of these type of service that some of you have done now. Well, you don't have to have a written agreement for participation, but for most other studies, like when you include people in a laboratory setting, for instance, if you invite people to work in front of an eye tracker, or when you do other types of experiments involving humans, you should have these types of written informed consent forms signed. There are exceptions, or there are situations where informed consent is very difficult to obtain, where you can't do this, and that is studies that involve what we call deception. Deception is when you are hiding the actual target of your study or the purpose of your study for the participants. Let's say you are trying to... let's say you're doing research on how you can design situations to make people give up their passwords, for instance. Well, you can't tell them beforehand that the purpose of this study is to try to trick you into giving away sensitive information. So you usually have some kind of a cover story. You tell them that you do something else. And that is acceptable in some cases. I'll come back to it. But there are very obvious limitations there. And one of the considerations that you have to do, even when you have informed consent, of course, is that you have to consider issues that has to do with cost and benefit in your study. The benefit of the study should be larger than the costs involved. I don't know if you remember you may have heard of a study called Milgram's study of obedience. It's a study where a lot of it's a social psychology study from the 1960s, where the researcher wanted to see how cruel humans could be, or how we can create situations where real cruelty comes out. He set up a situation where he recruited participants in the study as he told them that they were going to be his helper in the study. He told the participants that this was a study about learning, and we should see how punishment can actually increase learning, or can help in learning. So he told the participants that they were just his helper, and that he should, at Milgram's instructions, should give as a student in another room an electric shock every time he answered wrong on a simple memory task that he was going to perform. And every time he answered wrong, or every time a punishment was given, the punishment should be stronger. So every time this participant was going to punish, well, he had to increase on a very obviously looking instrument the amount of power in an electric shock, or the voltage in an electric shock. This instrument was clearly marked. On one side it said mild shock, and then it said medium shock, severe shock, maybe lethal shock, it said in the end. Or it's really serious stuff. And to Milgram's surprise, what happened was that more than half of his test subjects were willing to give potentially lethal shocks to participants on the other side of the glass that was in the other. There was a glass dividing, a window dividing the teacher and the student in this setting. Of course, very serious. And this was a typical deception type of study. What he didn't do in the beginning, well, what he did do was that he just sent people out after doing this, after taking part in this type of experiment. But people, of course, well, a lot of people actually broke down completely after the study. They, oh, what have I done? What happened here? Why did I do this? How could I do this? How could I give a really serious shock to a person on the other side just because some strong or some researcher told me to do it? So, was this justifiable in an ethical sense? Well, it raised a lot of debate, this type of study. And of course, it's an extreme example. You tell people that you're a potential killer, and you just send them out on the street afterwards. I don't know. It raised a lot of debate. It has been argued that, yes, it is, it's okay. And it's okay because of one thing. What we learned from a study like this was very valuable. Showing that people are willing to do stuff like this under pressure learned or made us learn a lot about human psychology. That authorities may make us killers or something like that. And he couldn't foresee that this actually, what he expected in the beginning here was that very few people would be willing to give very severe shocks in this situation. So he was a bit surprised as well. But in the conclusion is typically that, yes, this is okay. This was okay because the benefits from the what we learned from the study was so important that it justified what we did. And of course, you can counterbalance this by doing things afterwards. And what he did there was that he began debriefing people afterwards. He told them that what you did now was quite a normal thing to do. A lot of people does what you did here. And he told them about the hoax in the situation and why things were done the way it was. Called a debriefing session. And that, of course, helped a lot. But the problem is now, can we redo an experiment like this when things are stated? No, probably not. This is an extreme case, of course. But cost-benefit considerations should also be made in other situations. For instance, is it okay in a? How much time should you, let's say, steal from people? That could have been done where they could have been doing other things. If it's just a trivial thing you're going to investigate, how much should people need to invest of their time in it? Is it worth it? These are considerations you should make. Other stuff can, well, let's say you do some of you are going to do type of usability studies where you test out, for instance, new technology in companies. Or in companies, it can be also be for private, in private situations. If people feel very incompetent, if you make people feel stupid, incompetent when they use this technology, is that worth it? Is it so important, the stuff that you're investigating, that this is really worth the effort? Well, it may be important, but it may also be so trivial that you should have applied other types of strategies. In medical research now and then, you apply types of tests where you discover things that people could have lived without knowing. In psychology, we do tests where people are doing, well, let's say you do an intelligence test as a background for a type of study, and you may find out that some of the participants are really stupid. Should you tell them that? Or maybe they just discover it automatically. Is that good? Probably not. So you should be really careful with some of these things. You could say it's good for the research that we know these things, but there are things that should remain maybe undiscovered as well. So these are considerations. It's not strict rules, and it just points out the dilemmas that we have when we do research. And of course, we should be rather conservative when we do ethical considerations. Our primary consideration should be participant welfare in all these situations. Another obvious thing is, of course, stuff that has to do with privacy and confidentiality. Some of this is governed by legal stuff as well. You should make sure that people are not identifiable. They should never be identifiable when you do research in your reporting of your research. But it may be difficult now and then. And when you meet these, at least you should consider some of these difficulties. For instance, if you do research in limited populations, like a company, like a student group, or in employees at an organization or something like that, make sure that it isn't possible to trace information back to individuals in the organization. We do every 2 years or something, we do, for instance, here at this campus, we do an employee satisfaction type of study, where we ask people a lot of questions. How do you feel about being employed at HIG? How do you feel about your management? And this is, and some of these questions may be quite sensitive when you are going to tell something about your colleagues or your managers. Of course, when we are analyzing data from the whole institution, this is not very difficult. But when you split things up in the different departments, for instance, you look at the administration, and then you look at our department, MIT, you look at TUL. Well, even at that level, it can be okay. But then you can split things even more into detail. You can, for instance, the one at, you can trace back the answers from the one at MIT that has to do with economy, for instance, whose primary concern is tracing economy or stuff like that. Well, then you have a situation where you actually can trace back individual answers from individual persons in a questionnaire. And you should be very careful with stuff like this. In more situations than we are aware of, information is traceable. If you are, some of you will maybe do research that involves people with disabilities, for instance. You want to make technology that makes their life easier in some way. If you say something about their diagnosis, about their age, their gender, well, a lot of people may be able to, based on that information, be able to trace information back to even an individual. So even though you treat data anonymously, even though there are no link between who gave you the answers and the data, well, it's retraceable anyway. Any project that involves human subjects and where you treat that you at any level are dealing with personal information in Norway should be reported to an organization that, for us in Norwegian, Personvernombudet for forskning. It's called the, let me see what it's called in English, Data Protection Official for Research, it's called. This is an organization that takes care of some of these formal issues for us in research. And it tells you when we should report studies and what studies should be reported. A lot of studies we do actually needs to be reported. It's a very straightforward process. But if you do research where you at some level gather information that is, well, maybe you gather some background information from a database in some way. Maybe you have access to people's some kind of a birth number or identification there, personnummer. Even though you're not using this later, well, this study should be reported. You can find a lot of information on their net pages on these what type of project needs reporting. But more projects than you think needs to be reported. But as I said, it's a straightforward process as long as you are doing this in a university setting. When you do it in a private setting, it's a bit more complicated. And what projects should be reported then? Well, if you are just doing some kind of a survey study where you at no level have access to people's personal data, you don't need to report it. But if you are in a situation where you at some level have a link between, for instance, a database and responses, for instance, if you have invited people to take part in a study based on their membership in some organization or something like that. If that's the case, even though you are keeping separate records, that the process of inviting people was not linked to the data gathering itself, well, even though that's the case, you should make sure that you register your project. One situation that we often have, well, it's very tempting now today to use to gather data using tools that's available on the net, like Quest Back and stuff like that, which is an easy tool where you can make questionnaires. There are several of these things. Be aware that a lot of these tools keep track, for instance, of well, they keep a link between the invitation sent via email, for instance, and the responses given in the questionnaire. And they trace IP addresses. And when that's the case, you should always report your study to NSD. That's and it Well, now and then it's you're not aware of this, that this happens in these fields. But when that's the case, the project should be reported, even though you don't use that data. The potential of using the data is what triggers this report process. The stuff that's written in this foil is stuff you can find yourself on the net. They have put out checklists, for instance, of what types of projects you need to report. It's just a few more words about deceptive research. As I said, we do. It's okay to do deceptive research if the cost-benefit considerations are done in a proper way. But there are pitfalls. So, as a general rule, if you can avoid deception, like the first experiment I told you about, where I was this test subject in a very intrusive type of study. It was somewhat a deceptive thing because they were hiding the purpose. They weren't hiding the purpose, but they were hiding the procedures in the experiment. It could have been done differently. So try to avoid deception wherever it's not needed. When you can't tell about the purpose of an experiment, well, tell it. If you have to do deceptions, if that's necessary to get the data or get the results you're after, well, make sure that you at least are having a debriefing session, that you take people aside after they have been participating in a study and tell them what the purpose of the study was and maybe why they did as they did. And so you desensitize them a bit afterwards. If you don't have access to people afterwards, I'd say if you do this, so you do studies on the internet, for instance, where you try to make people give away personal information, social engineering types of studies, it's what typically what you call it in information security. If you do that type of studies on the net, well, be very careful that you actually are able to trace your, or able to de-hoax and are able to debrief your test subjects afterwards. Because people may feel really stupid and may feel that they've done something really bad if they are being trapped in a situation where they gave away data and discover it afterwards, and maybe are afraid that this will be used in some way. So try to avoid these things when you don't have access to people, which often is the case when you do things online. Just in the end here, a few words about consequences or the relationship between society and your research. There is always a choice. You don't have to report every finding in a study. If the consequences of those findings are somewhat, I don't know, may be sensitive. And there are a number of these hot areas where you should be really we should consider what type of results that you choose to report. For instance, stuff that has to do with gender, race, religion. Religion is very important here. You should be it should be really justified if you choose to, well, let's say that you discover some kind of a gender difference in a study you do, or you discover some kind of a difference between different cultures or people belonging to different religions. Is the difference, for instance, big enough to report? Is it big enough to focus on? Should we make sure that when we report this, we also make sure that all the uncertainties, all the discussion that's important for understanding a difference is well communicated to the population? Yes, you should always do that. You should always make sure that you discuss these kinds of findings very good, so that you don't end up in these very popularized or this very popular tabloid conclusions on these issues. It's very easy to make early conclusions, and you should be careful with the data you report. Research is not apolitical. There is always consequences when you conclude on something. Yeah, this was just a few topics that has to do with ethical research. Some of these guidelines that we have just touched here can also be found on the net. There are always, at least in Norway, we have a few very nice places on the net where you can find this type of information and these types of debates, and where you can find checklists and guidelines for doing ethical research. De norske forskningsetiske komiteene, Etikkom. I've put a in fronter. You can see that I've put a link, or maybe I even put the whole document there. I'm not sure. A document that are the Norwegian guidelines for technical research. And you can also find the source of them there, which is then etikkom.no. De norske forskningsetiske komiteen. You can find these in other countries as well, I guess. They're English. I think most of the guidelines there are translated into English as well. So it's a good source for these discussions on ethics in research. And they have nice publications there. Okay, I think we stop there, and then we start doing data analysis for those of you who are going to take part in that. So, I don't know, we will meet again next Wednesday as well for presentations of the research projects, and maybe we will have some time there to discuss the exam. I will give you some information about the exam there as well.